Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham coming at you today nearly live from Ottawa, Ontario, where Capital Pride kicks off later this week. And it's been a summer of Pride events, big-time Pride events in this country. We had World Pride in Toronto earlier in the summer, and now sort of the summer ending Capital Pride in the nation's capital. And this year, there was a post that came out in June that was really interesting on the Notches blog, which was entitled Coming Out in the Classroom When the Personal is Pedagogical. And I wanted to get the author of this piece on the podcast, so we have him. He is an honorary research fellow at Birkbeck University of London and a Shirk postdoctoral fellow at McGill. And it is Justin Bengry. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, and thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for doing this all the way from London, England.
Yeah, no, this is exciting for me, too. I mean, being originally from Canada myself, it was great to have you from ActiveHistory.ca get in touch. So I'm thrilled to be part of this.
Oh, thanks. It's exciting for us. First time we've ever had somebody on the show who's recording not in North America, which is fun for us. And for you personally, first of all, I mean, you're affiliated with McGill, but you're based in England there. I mean, how does that work out for you just logistically?
It's not too bad. McGill has been incredibly supportive, as has Birkbeck. I applied to McGill with the Shirk with the expectation that I would be coming to England, in part to continue doing research since my primary area of focus is British history, but also to live with my partner, who's a London-based filmmaker. So It was both professional and personal combining in happy ways that it all came together. And Birkbeck was a supportive environment that has a really strong focus in the history department on sexuality. And they've welcomed me with an honorary appointment there to make life easier with affiliation and accreditation.
When you have an institution that is supportive of something that may not be typical, it makes things so much easier, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I've definitely seen a lot of other universities where I suppose it's not that they're not supportive of these subjects and these questions. It's just there's not really people on staff covering them. And Birkbeck is really unusual in that it's got this amazing critical mass, even within London and the UK, of people that are working on various aspects of sexuality and queer history in different periods. So it's just a wonderful group of people to be working around.
Now, I mentioned the blog post, and as I said, it was entitled Coming Out in the Classroom When the Personal is Pedagogical. And basically what you do in this post is that you discuss the issues surrounding whether or not you should come out, or not, you shouldn't say should, whether you come out to your students when teaching gay history. And you talk to different faculty members from different schools in Canada, and each of them have their own different reasons. So I was just wondering, for you personally, what was the impetus to write this particular article discussing addressing your sexuality with students?
Well, it's always been an interest of mine. And the fact that I researched the history of sexuality and 20th century queer British history specifically brings it into the forefront of where I want to go professionally. But then, funnily enough, I've not really had the opportunity to teach very much queer history. I've typically taught surveys of political history, the usual sort of undergrad, first year, second year surveys. And the one course that I did teach that was a gender history course was much more women's history. So there was opportunities to teach some gay and lesbian history, but it was much more gender history and women's history. But I'm interested, especially now that I'm on the job market, looking at positions in different places in Canada, the States, and Britain. It just, I suppose, got me thinking more and more about issues of teaching, issues of pedagogy. I'm also here surrounded just by really great teachers that that think about their historical practice and their pedagogical practice on a regular basis. So it was just, in the process of brainstorming for blog ideas for the Notches blog, it was one that seemed a fairly obvious choice for me, and something that that I was interested in, that combined teaching, research, and my editing activities on the blog.
In writing the piece, and when you approach different faculty members or different professors, what was that process like? Because especially the people who you talk to who didn't come out to students or don't necessarily feel it's necessary, how do you approach the issue with them? I mean, if they don't, if there's this notion of, well, it's not necessarily relevant, so why would they want to be part of this piece? I mean, how do you approach that type of an issue?
Well, I did admittedly only contact people that I knew already, that I had a certain varying levels of personal relationships with, and ones that I knew also taught queer history courses. So I knew that minimally they'd be interested in these questions, but I didn't really know how they would approach it. And I really didn't know either what they actually did in their own teaching practice. I mean, I know them on a non-professional level for the most part. So I don't actually see how they teach their students, how they position themselves in the classroom. I don't think I've ever actually seen any of them teaching. I've seen them in conference settings, which is different again, with sort of professional colleagues at the same level, but I've never seen them at the head of a classroom. So it was really interesting as I pondered how I might approach these things, given the future opportunity to teach again. It was interesting to think about and ask how they do it. Mm-hmm. And all three of them I contacted one other person that was in the UK, and just timelines didn't work for him to be able to get back to me in the timeline that I hope to have the piece ready. But the three Canadians that are in the blog post all responded quite straightforwardly and really helpfully. And it worked out really, really usefully that they had very different approaches and very mm-hmm. different reasons for what they did.
Yeah, and that's why I thought you sort of approached a bunch of different people and then sort of found the three different answers to put it in. But those were the three people who you initially approached, and it's just sort of worked out that way. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it just worked out so well that there was a really good contrast between them, that Brian Lewis, who's also my postdoctoral supervisor right now at McGill, and a professor there, he probably had the most sort of expected, anticipated, straightforward response, that for him it was part of coming out, that it was a political gesture to show students that a gay man could be active in the academy, that queer history was valid, all of these things mm-hmm. That are incredibly useful, but also that was the more expected response. And it could also be generational, that I think Brian is also older than the other two, came of age at a different moment, engaged in politics differently, and that, of course, influences his teaching practice. Jennifer Evans at Carleton had a different response, that she wanted to, in some ways, not identify herself in any particular way, and also undermine the idea that you need to have a particular identity to authentically teach gay and lesbian history. Which was a really good counter to this idea of a sort of politics of visibility that, important though they are, tend to overwhelm conversations sometimes. And then Sheila McManus, an associate professor at Lethbridge, was just so reflective on her own position as an historical actor, and her own sort of changing political identity, her changing sexual identity, and how open she was about that with students as a pedagogical tool itself. That was just, I thought that was really exciting.
And it is. And for anyone who hasn't read the piece, we'll link to it in the post for this podcast. So you can go to activehistory.ca and click on the post, and we'll have the link there. Or you can just Google coming out in the classroom, Justin Van Green. It's the first thing that comes up. And you can read all this here. And so you have these three different viewpoints on this. And then you sort of put yourself into the equation, and you say that you don't come out directly to your students, and you imply that, you know, you talk about what you study and what your research is, and you write that you think that they could figure it out pretty easily just from you presenting yourself the way you present yourself. And I'm wondering sort of where this comes from and why you feel as though that this is the best way for you to do things in your classes. I realize you mentioned that you haven't really taught much queer history. So how relevant is your research or your sexuality to teaching a political survey course? And is that sort of the reason, or is it sort of you just still sort of finding your way in the classroom and trying to figure out what works best for you as an instructor?
I think it's a combination, actually. I think the way that I presented it in the blog post, that it was really about the content of my courses, that it would be unusual to inject that into my my personal biography in the classroom or introduction when it would. I mean, there's an argument for it to be made that there's obviously going to be, just statistically, there's going to be gay and lesbian students in the classroom, and having an example of a gay instructor could offer all kinds of useful opportunities for visibility, for comfort, for opening other dialogues and whatnot. But I certainly presented it in the blog in terms of, I've typically taught 20th century European history, and I've injected some lectures with gender history and histories of sexuality. But for the most part, I'm teaching the Treaty of Versailles or the Cold War or very sort of political economic elements, which isn't to say, of course, that those aren't inflected by sexualities in interesting ways or can't bring up interesting conversations about sexualities. But I haven't yet been in the opportunity to fully create my own courses. I've been taking over existing courses. So that's one of the reasons. Also, I think it is fair to say that, I mean, I've had, I suppose, a fair bit of experience teaching over the last decade or so, mostly as a TA and later as a postdoctoral instructor. But I've really only taught as the instructor of record two or three times. So I definitely am still finding my feet in the classroom and getting more comfortable. And I suppose writing this blog is also a sort of thinking through writing for how I will proceed in the future. Right. But it's an ongoing process.
Do you think that, and you can look at this from a teaching perspective, but also in the way you do in your research, that people who study gay history, it's almost implied that they're gay, or that, you know, their sexuality is informing their research? Because it seems to me that that happens in gay and lesbian history in a way that doesn't happen in other history. I mean, I study broadcasting, and people don't assume that I'm a cinephile or anything. I mean, I just study broadcasting. And yet, with history of sexuality, it seems as though there's this presumption of a personal interest that goes beyond just being curious, that it sort of informs their personal lives in a way that it's different for other disciplines. Do you find that as well?
Oh, there's certainly that assumption.
Right.
I think it certainly comes out of a whole generation of scholars that were activists in the gay and lesbian movements from the 70s and 80s onward, that their research, their academic work was part of their activist work, and they were actively involved in queer politics as queer men and women. And I think that really shaped the field in so many ways that has effects to the present. It certainly doesn't speak for the experience of every single scholar of sexuality or of queer studies, queer history, but it certainly inflects the field and informs expectations and stereotypes of scholars in the field, even among ourselves, I suppose. I mean, I catch myself every once in a while meeting someone that does, say, British queer history or another country's queer history, and discovering that they identify as heterosexual, and I catch myself being surprised, and then sort of catching myself saying, well, why should I be surprised?
Right.
But that certainly is the history of the field. And it's an ongoing trajectory. But I think that's why Jennifer Evans' element of the blog, the interview that she gave, was so useful, because it really questioned that and called us to really question our understandings of who is teaching queer history and implicitly what their motivations, their interests, their curiosities might be. But I think you're right that this is probably stronger in gay and lesbian histories, among scholars of gay and lesbian history, but certainly not limited to it. I've got friends that have done PhDs in post-colonial cultures, in African history, in other areas, and sometimes they do get into situations where they're asked, like, well, what are you doing telling the history of this place or of these people? Especially when issues of race come into play. I think it quite easily gets dismantled quite quickly, but they still encounter that kind of question of identification and authenticity and validity for the people whose stories they're telling. And of course, we always have a responsibility for being aware of how we tell the stories of the people that we research, particularly for communities that continue to exist and have political identities themselves. But it is an ongoing and regular feature of gay and lesbian history, certainly.
And it's definitely an issue when you talk about things like appropriation and somebody not from a community going in and having the sense that they're appropriating the story for their own personal gain. Mm-hmm. And that's a really dangerous thing. And then I guess that's sort of where that assumption comes from. Well, then, it's almost like you have to have a vested interest personally to be able to engage with it professionally. And otherwise, you are appropriating the subject, which I don't think is the case, but I can see why people in that community would have that impression.
Or other scholars critiquing the work of peers and colleagues. I think it's always a fair conversation to have, because we should always be thinking about how we're presenting the people we research and always thinking about questions of power and privilege. And we in the academy are profoundly powerful and privileged in our positions researching other groups, other cultures, other communities. So to always be forced to reckon with that and consider it and be aware of it is certainly a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. Definitely. And Ian Mosby, he says this, I think a lot in his talks. He recognizes that in his work on nutritional experiments on First Nations students at residential schools, that he is approaching this from his position of power as a white male in the academy. And he's cognizant of this, and he's trying to, you know, understand that he has this position. He wants to be respectful of that, and that he's not trying to appropriate anything. And it's an interesting dynamic when you're coming to a community as not somebody from that community to do it. And there's a balance there that everyone has to find.
Mm-hmm. But then there's another interesting thing, which is what I started thinking about most at the end of my blog post, is when you really are from the community that you're researching, and mm-hmm. who's getting excluded when you're telling stories of people that basically look like you. So, I mean, I certainly am comfortable doing the research that I do, but of course my teaching goes beyond that. And especially Sheila's responses to the blog questions made me think about how I might present myself in the future beyond just sexuality to my students when I'm teaching. And who gets typically excluded in queer history research and what's out there right now. And it really presents an interesting opportunity to be able to identify my whiteness, identify my class position, how that's changed, how my education has informed that, but also affected or obscured that. All of these things that some of the students would identify with or not, but it immediately casts into relief those people who would fall outside of those categories and gives us an opportunity to discuss how these groups and individuals who are less privileged don't get into our research in some cases as readily, or into our classrooms. We might even talk about all of these things. It just brings up issues that are really useful to inform our teaching, our classroom experiences, and our education.
Yeah, and that brings up an interesting point too, and it's something that I've talked with people about, and something that I've always been curious about, is that you look at things like Pride Week, and the way it's framed to me, or the way it appears to be framed, is that people are identified by their sexuality as the primary marker of who they are. And just like you said, there's so many more things that compose a human being mm-hmm. that to present as your sexuality as your primary marker, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And maybe that's just because it's not I don't do it, and so I don't understand why or where that comes from. But it's the same thing as if you're presenting as a person, as a regular human being in a class, there's so much more to identify yourself by than just sexuality. Obviously, sexuality would have a part, but is it fair then to expect that sexuality would be a primary part and sort of the first thing that would need to be addressed?
I think the issue then is to sort of consider for the individual about whom we're speaking. For some people, their sexuality really is the primary element of their identity, that they want to forward in conversation, in dialogue, in self-expression, especially for older folks, especially for some of the people that I've recently been meeting for oral history interviews, that it's really important for them now for to have that opportunity, in contrast with decades ago where they were, well, in danger from the law, the state, authorities, all these other dangers that they don't feel in the same way right now. And bearing in mind, these are also the ones I've been speaking to are, again, older British white men, gay men. So they don't have much to fear from the state right now, but working class, people of color, other marginalized people, recent immigrants, all still under the rubric of gay and lesbian citizens, would have different relationships with the state, with authorities, with other, well, other citizens for that matter. So, and might have other elements of their identity that are much more important to their to their personhood. But I think in bringing up pride, you're also anticipating bringing up some important issues about the conflict, about what pride means these days. And there certainly is, I think, conflict among the sort of, the term gay community as a kind of big catch-all that represents everybody. But it is one that the sort of, we understand as being a bit sort of broader conversation. And certainly among people that would identify as gay and lesbian, there's a lot of conflict about what pride means, how it's changed, how it might have been depoliticized, more commercialized. There's also, so that sort of speaks to sort of older folks who might have seen it as more radical and political in the past, and even more potentially more inclusive in the past, and that's been lost. Right. But then there's also younger folks, people younger than me, that don't feel any kind of identification with the need to assert their visibility because it's never been threatened. It's never been under jeopardy. They've never felt any different than their peers. And so they feel no necessity to be involved in pride events, in marching, in political activism whatsoever, which is a tricky one because on the one hand, that's a kind of wonderful success to gay liberation that people don't feel any danger or any threat or any need to worry or to be scared. But it also severs a political relationship and an activism that's really, really, really important to generations of individuals that then feel that break strongly and powerfully.
But I guess that leads to another question then, is that this younger generation, people who are, you know, would be our students now, people who, you know, 18 to 22 or whatever the normal range for a student in a post-secondary classroom would be, they've grown up in a world that is different from the way, you know, in the world Brian Lewis grew up in. And the question that needs to be asked is, does the average student in a classroom care about their professor's sexuality? Does it matter to them? I mean, they grew up, a lot of people have kids in high school, they're coming out now, and the culture is so different with the presence of a gay community, and they're being exposed to it, you know, starting when they're 10 years old, really. And by the time you get to university, it's just part of their lives. And does the fact then that the professor is gay, straight, bisexual, whatever, does that even matter to the average student?
I think, again, there's going to be a lot of different responses to that. And I think you're right that for many, it's almost kind of, maybe they assumed, maybe they don't care. Maybe for them, it's just completely incidental and almost trivial. But I mean, we're also kind of assuming big universities in large metropolitan cities where students will have been exposed to a lot more throughout their entire lives beyond maybe media and widespread popular culture that discusses homosexuality more anyway. But I don't know that that's the same case in smaller communities, in even outside of the major cities, or even within those kids, the students that might have come from more isolated places or families with different priorities, politics, whatnot, coming to the city, coming to another city, just maybe getting space for themselves or still being in their same city or their home city, that they might have another response as well. And that's not just students who may identify as LGBT, but for other students as well. I mean, it was interesting for me teaching for a couple of years in Saskatoon, because the city is a reasonable sized city of, I don't know, 250,000 people. So it's certainly not Hamlet. And the university itself was quite a good size, tens of thousands of students. So, I mean, on the outside, it looked like a relatively urban area with a good sized university. But I feel like a lot of my students hadn't really been exposed to very much, even though, like you said, they're in the city, they're exposed to popular culture, they're at the university, they're supposed to be coming into contact with all these new experiences and different kinds of people and opportunities and whatnot. But I didn't, and certainly that was true for some of them, but a lot of them, I don't think that was the case. And it was really interesting for me, because I think I probably assumed much more exposure and awareness among my students than was always the case. And like I said, the courses I taught there were generally political survey history courses, but teaching the Cold War, for instance, there's the opportunity to talk about Cold War issues around gay and lesbians in the civil service, most commonly in the McCarthy era, but also in Britain, since it was a European history course. So there was overlaps to questions of sexuality, and there was a lot that was new to them. So I think that for many of them, it's true, this might not matter at all. And for many of them, it might matter a lot.
And I guess the issue then is the instructors, and is how do you find the ones to whom it matters a lot? And because those are the ones, in theory, who, you know, you could really make sort of a connection with and, you know, help them in their growth, not so much as a student, but maybe just as a person, in engaging with different things and learning about different people and different cultures. And obviously this would go beyond just sexuality, but it's sort of a, you know, it can help them do this in other aspects of their life. So it goes beyond just the academic then.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Well, and I think you cast it to the wind. I mean, they're going to have to self-identify in a certain way to as being more interested in following up, as being more invested in learning more, discovering more. And maybe that's not even going to happen in your classroom. Maybe this is just something that brings up an issue that they're going to pursue down the road somewhere else, and you'll never know. And I think you're absolutely right to remind us that this isn't just sexuality. This is all kinds of questions, issues that we can be exposed to in the university classroom. But I think that's the main thing is put it out there and see what happens on a variety of fronts, a variety of topics, like as I mentioned, class, ethnicity, education, all of these things are equally valid positions of identity to potentially discuss in a classroom.
Yeah, and there's definitely value in discussing them. And I know I went to Nipissing University, and I don't recall anyone publicly being out. And I'm sure there were people who were publicly out. I know there was a pride group on campus. I don't think I knew anybody who was in it. From what I know, it was a rather small group. And then I also went to University of the West Indies, where not only was there nobody publicly out, it was generally frowned upon. And I talked about this with Vereen Shepherd from the Mona campus in Jamaica, but I was in Barbados. And there was still this mentality, the Caribbean is very conservative, or was very conservative, in terms of their approaches to women and homosexuality. And you could just see that on campus there was a tension whenever the issue came up. There certainly wasn't a gay history class or a queer history class on campus. And it struck me as really interesting in that, you know, it's an idea that people are uncomfortable with there. And yet the university, where, you know, that's the place to talk about things that are uncomfortable, to really address them, and then the university wasn't doing it. And the student community, even outside of classrooms, there was no discussion about it. And it was this sort of issue that, you know, on whole, people would just say it's wrong and let's not talk about it. And it struck me as, well, then is not the university failing its students by allowing this to happen and by not addressing something that makes them uncomfortable? It always bothered me that, you know, if people have, you know, I'm certainly not one to judge anybody else's point of view. You know, if, you know, somebody wrote an article when I was there and they talked about how homosexuality was morally wrong, you know, I disagree with that. But, you know, if that's your belief, that's your belief. Okay. But at the same time, I think the university is the place to foster the discussion between that person and somebody on the other side to at least get a dialogue going. And the fact that it wasn't happening really bothered me, and it really made me realize that really what universities should be doing at a fundamental level is exposing people to, you know, different ideas, different points of view, and, you know, allow them to make their own decisions at the end of the day, but at least expose them to it and have the conversations. And if coming out in a classroom allows that at some level, then there's truly value to it.
But then we've got to be careful, too, not to put too much of an onus on instructors to potentially put themselves in harm's way. I mean, we've been talking mostly about sort of Canada, Britain, places where it's generally going to be safe to come out in the classroom.
Right.
But in other areas, now when you're talking about the Caribbean, there's entirely other social and cultural issues at play,
right.
And political and legal for that matter. Places where sodomy laws are still intact and homophobic laws are still active, where the act of coming out in the classroom, while profoundly political and activist, can also be profoundly dangerous potentially. It brings up a lot of difficult issues because, exactly as you say, I mean, the value of the university coming out of a liberal arts tradition is to question and to learn and to be exposed to new ideas. And if that's not happening, then we see a problem in that, certainly. But I guess the problem is the university is also really a institution made up of the people who inhabit it. And if the people who inhabit it hold certain values, certain political positions, then that will fundamentally inflect the university itself, or for that matter, the state in which it is going, in which it exists, and the politics under which it exists will fundamentally affect what it can do as well. And I mean, the idealist in me hopes that that's always challenged and always questioned, but people have to put themselves at risk for that to happen in many instances, and we can't really necessarily put the onus on instructors to do that.
No, that's true. That's a good point. And I guess maybe it would have to come then from the administrative level, and not necessarily even somebody coming out and just saying, you know, we're going to run this class or we're going to have this conversation, and it's going to be, because we need to. It's important. And because it's almost, it strikes me as the way in which it gets approached sometimes, the way in which people approached segregation in the 50s. I don't want to equate the two in the way in which they're actually practiced, but in the way in which people would talk about them is this sort of, let's not talk about it. We know it exists, but if we don't talk about it, we don't have to really do anything about it, and then that's fine, and we can go on living our lives. And that doesn't strike me as the most productive way to deal with any issue, is to just ignore it.
No. Well, and I think you're right. That, I mean, I think it can come in a couple different directions. If there is someone from the administration level that can or will take a position and try to challenge their institution, that can have an impact. But there's also got to be something at the grassroots, something among students, something to a sort of willingness and desire to explore and be exposed to different ideas and to demand that as well.
Right.
And it seems like they really have to work in eventually at some point they have to work in tandem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. There's a partnership between the students and the university.
Mm-hmm. But also not to cast all the sort of failure of this to happen on extreme situations like that. I mean, one of the interesting things to come out of the blog was some of the comments I got either on the blog or privately from people that are in North American and British universities saying that they haven't said anything about their sexuality and they haven't brought it up in teaching situations, not because they have an active political and pedagogical reason for not doing so like Jennifer has, but because they're not in positions of secure employment, stability, locations that they feel are as progressive or as open. And one woman spoke to me about working at a religious institution where she just didn't feel that her employment was safe or secure, or perhaps her sort of conditions of being employed were secure enough to self-identify in that way in her teaching. Others, I think it was in the comments on the blog itself, noted correctly that the people that were interviewed, two of them are associate professors and one is a full professor, which also gives an incredible degree of latitude and sort of personal security and certainty that their employment is secure. They're even if say graduate students that are TAs or introductory lecturers aren't going to be likely to be fired or harassed or destabilized in their employment for their sexuality in North America or Britain these days, even if that's the legal reality, is that danger is incredibly diminished from what it was not that long ago. The fact remains that people still feel precarious in their early career or in their student days and don't want to necessarily court conflict where they don't necessarily know how that will play out on a personal or professional level. When they still don't know the profession, they still don't know necessarily how their departments and their professors and their colleagues might react, that it is emotionally safer perhaps to go under the radar a bit more until, well, as they said, I mean, the people I spoke to were in secure tenured positions.
Yeah. But is that necessarily just have to do with sexuality so much as it could just be, you know, anything? I mean, you know, if you're in a classroom, you know, you don't want to, and you don't really know exactly what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, maybe you just don't do it. Don't talk about anything personal at all. Out of this fear of not trying to inject too much of yourself into the material and let the material just speak for itself. It could be part of a learning curve.
Yeah, I think you're right. That is, again, it comes back to the sort of finding your feet as a teacher. Mm-hmm. But I think also another comparison would be, say, individuals who are really, really politically activist on say, any topic, that they might not feel comfortable injecting that politics or that belief in their teaching. Just because they don't know how it'll jive with maybe a department that's more moderate or colleagues that are more moderate or whatnot. Right. So you're right. I mean, I think that it speaks to the issues encountered in a lot of personal identity positions and political positions as well that you might bring to your teaching or you might not for all the reasons we've been discussing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think I've ever discussed my politics in my classes either. And granted, I'm in a position where the last two courses I've taught have been popular culture courses. So whenever I've injected something personal, it's been, you know, my reaction to a movie or my experience going to sporting events or something, which is relatively benign and stuff that really no one's going to take an issue with. The only thing that people got mad at me about is when I talked about Star Wars, and you know, I've never seen Star Wars, and people got really upset with me. But again, even that's kind of just a silly thing to get upset about, right? I mean, although I probably get a letter from somebody saying it's not silly to get upset that you haven't seen Star Wars, you should really see it. But it's stuff that really it doesn't matter. It doesn't inform much other than just I haven't seen the movie and I can't then therefore really talk about it other than the reaction to it and its place in popular culture, the significance of it. I can't talk about the plot. But, you know, I don't think I would talk about politics because, you know, like you say, I'm on tenuous ground here, and I don't really know how to approach these things in a way that works in a classroom.
Yeah, well, it's a funny one too, because I mean, I guess I can see it from both sides, because on the one hand, if we go back to what we were just talking about what the ideal of the university is, yeah, to expose students to new ideas and to challenge them and to make them interrogate their own ideas, and potentially their own positions will become stronger by that, by having that opposition, and perhaps they'll change their opinion, whatever happens in the course of these conversations and exposures throughout their education. So on the one hand, I can certainly see a place for professors and instructors who are clearly open about their political positions or identity positions, but right now we're talking about politics more, and have a clear position on what that is, with the understanding that students can then evaluate that and sort of see someone who's talking the talk and walking the walk potentially, and observing that, hopefully then also being exposed to all kinds of other ideas that they can then evaluate on their own. But of course, we always come back to the problem that professors are in a position of power and authority over students. And while that might be an ideal to have professors that can be very political in a classroom, and then students that will have the complete freedom to come to their own conclusions after evaluating that, the fact remains that they're still being evaluated, they're still being graded, they're still trying to get into grad school with those grades or get into careers, and they're not necessarily going to feel that same freedom to disagree with professors. So it does create, yeah, because of those power differentials, I don't have a solution. I mean, I'd love to have a university where it could be this wonderful clearinghouse of ideas where everything is out there and students then evaluate on their own. But the reality is that it's not a complete equal playing field. And then also having been, I did my PhD in California, and in the States, there's certainly a much more vocal concern about the so-called danger of activist professors. And there were lists of the quote 100 most dangerous professors, which, I mean, we were quite happy that some in our department would make it onto that list. We considered it quite a good mark of our success.
Right.
But I mean, that also creates other tensions and other potential dangers and potential conflicts for the students, for the department, for the professors. I mean, I believe the faculty in my department that were being identified in this way were also very senior professors with very stable positions, respected scholars that could take risks and make political stands inside and outside the academy. And maybe a junior untenured professor doesn't have that power to do so in the classroom or outside of it, if there's going to be a sort of machine of attack coming at them from another political position that sees the academy as a danger in sometimes.
Well, that's a really good point, and it's true. And I think that's something that I think it's starting to seep into Canada a little bit, but that's definitely strikes me as a more American dynamic. I don't know what it's like in the UK. But
yeah, I don't feel it. I don't sense it over here. I think there's problems with support for academia and a sort of anti-intellectualism among government funding bodies, the government itself, and big problems with higher education here, but they aren't the same kind of partisan political attack right, of ideas that I saw in the States.
Hmm. Now, I want to get back to something you said about these power dynamics, which is something that's really interesting and something that definitely would go into informing how you approach your relationship with students as an instructor. And one of the things that I've talked about with people, I think I talked about it with Heather Murray on the podcast we did on her book on the relationships between gay kids and their parents, was this notion of sexual identity and voyeurism. And if studies of sexuality have a tendency then to go towards voyeurism in the sense that sexuality, as far as I can tell, is a very personal thing, and it's something that generally gets expressed privately. You know, the full-on expression of sexuality is a private act, and sort of the Trudeau idea of, you know, the state has no business in people's bedrooms. And yet now it's this notion of making the private public and then bringing that into a classroom and how that then relates to students and this idea of power dynamics. So basically you're bringing yourself in, you're saying, and I say you, but I don't mean you specifically, the sort of generic faculty member who does this. Mm-hmm. You come into the classroom and you say, you identify your sexuality. So if you do that right away, as say Brian Lewis does, the power dynamic to me shifts a little bit in that, similar to a professor who comes in and starts to address their political views, that students may be affected in how they approach the material by trying to fit within the what they believe is that professor's expectations. But then there's this other element as well of, for people, say, who don't identify their sexuality, yet there's this hint towards what their sexuality is, then there's this, to me, voyeurism to that. And you have students maybe gossiping and talking about, well, is this person or aren't they, you know what I mean? And how does that all sort of come together to ensure that the main focus of the course is the material itself and you're not distracting from what the purpose of the course really is, and that is to teach the material?
Well, I guess the issue there then is that the professors I've spoken to who actively self-identify, rather than seeing it as opening up a possibility that creates a dynamic where the students want to reflect what the professor wants them to see or write or whatnot, instead, those professors saw it more as breaking the ice, that the class could be more open in conversation. There were less sort of established taboos about what was okay to talk about, and that it could create a more positive environment for actually digging into the material and getting past a lot of stuff right away that might have slowed that or prevented the fullest exploitation of the material and interrogation of the material. So, yeah, I can definitely see where you're coming from. And I think it's one that these individuals I've spoken to have considered, but on the whole then evaluated that there's far more good done by creating greater discussion and deeper discussion, that the students can be more invested in the discussion as well, potentially, too.
Hmm. Do you think that there is a voyeurism in the study of sexuality?
Sure. Actually, yeah, there's got to be. Why not? And but I guess I paused because, I mean, voyeurism has a a bit of a negative connotation, doesn't it?
Sure.
But does it have to? I mean, if sort of that sort of titillation is what gets someone interested in the topic to really get into it a bit more and expose them to something, well, that's not a bad thing.
Here's where it could be. And I wrote about when Tom Daley put out his video, last year, the next day the press used words like bisexual and gay and coming out. And if you watch that video, he doesn't use any of those words.
Mm.
And so what I wrote at the time was, I mean, why are we putting this identity on him that he's not self-identifying as, at least at the time? I have no idea what he's done since. But at the time, he did not identify as any of those things, and yet it was placed on him. And it struck me as that's not fair to him. And that's what I wrote about. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that the same thing could happen in any sort of study of sexuality, is that, you know, people identify in different ways, and particularly when it's done privately, then what you're doing is going into their personal life, into a part of their life that maybe they didn't want exposed publicly. And that's maybe not fair to that person. And that's something that strikes me, is that dynamic then could play into a classroom dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a lot of things at play there, though. I mean, I think you're right with Tom Daley, that the reception and discussion of him demonstrated that we want to have clear-cut categories. And if he undermined that, then he kind of got pushed out of the way more in the interests of a clear category that would be a good headline. And certainly there's all kinds of issues that brings up. But in teaching and research as well, I mean, I think we're often, as historians, digging into people's private lives and exposing things they would have never wanted exposed, not even just the sexual, but just all kinds of elements of their lives that we expose. We put these to the public, we evaluate them, we might put interpretations on them that they certainly wouldn't have done in their own lives or their own periods, maybe because they would have actively opposed what we're saying, or they didn't have the language or concepts to put them together in the ways that we choose to now. But even though there is that voyeurism, and now I'm using the term non-sexually, but it works just as well in a sexual context. Even though that might be, well, not might be, it certainly is the case in a lot of historical research. We need to be aware then that our uses of these people of the past and potentially of the present serves something and informs knowledge and creates knowledge and helps us understand them better, helps us understand ourselves better. I don't think we're going to get away from it in any way, but having that awareness, I think, is really important. And being aware of when the line is crossed. I mean, this is something that we've encountered on the Notches blog with other posts, where we have researchers from all eras from the medieval period on. We're still hoping to one day get some ancient history on there, but it's yet to happen. But we've had posts in the past where, naturally, because of dealing with history of sexuality and sometimes working with personal documents, case files, personal memoirs, elements of private lives from the past that may not have ever been intended for publication, but are the historians' tools and sources, we've had to ask some of our contributors, well, what does the evidence that you're presenting contribute to the claims you're making? And in some cases, we've had to say, like, this doesn't feel right. This doesn't feel like something that should be published on our blog, not because it's inherently wrong or dirty or unsavory or problematic or something like that, but because it's not justified by analysis that needs that evidence to be there. If it just becomes purely voyeuristic for no enlightening purpose, then there is a line that academics should be aware of, and as editors, we've tried to define for our contributors.
Right, it's that point where the sexuality affects sort of other aspects of their life, maybe, or where the sexuality is a relevant part of whatever is being investigated. If it's
not necessarily just sexuality, but just personal details of. Right. Of anything. I mean, down from identity to personal activities and elements of one's relationships in any context. I mean, certainly this, on the most basic level, we encounter this with whether to anonymize names or use authentic names of people when we're identifying them historically. But I mean, it goes much, that's just the most basic level, but certainly beyond that as well, when it comes to actual facts and experiences of their lives, it has to support some kind of interpretation. It has to actually be evidence and not just trivia.
Right, right. And because that is important, because sometimes, and I think you get this with sort of the founding fathers of the United States when people talk about, oh, this guy was sleeping with this person and so on and so forth. And it's like, well, does that matter? Like, who cares? Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the issue then that I've discussed about sexuality. I mean, you know, if this person is going home with a man or going home with a woman, but one, they don't identify as their sexuality, and two, it doesn't really seem to have an impact on why we're studying them, then is that the sort of thing that you need to bring up? And it happens a lot in sports too, where the beat writers and the columnists they talk about how there are guys who are openly gay within locker rooms, but they're not going to be public about it. And so that's respected by the writers, that they're not going to talk about it. The other players on the team, they'll know about it, but they're not going to talk about it. And it's this notion of, well, because the sexuality does not affect their play on the field. It doesn't affect their relationship with the rest of the team. And they don't really want to talk about it publicly, so we're not going to talk about it publicly. So it strikes me as that there's a similar dynamic at play within the study of sexuality, the history of sexuality.
There's certainly, yeah, similar pressures that are in place. But I would also say it's a lot about context. So you give the example of the founding fathers and who they might be sleeping with.
Yeah.
And if one is talking about their sort of political activities and domestic politics, international politics, whatnot, certainly the fact that they might be having extramarital affairs or homosexual affairs isn't going to speak to that project.
Right.
But in another context, if you are writing about, say, race relationships and interracial children and whatnot, and there's examples of founding fathers that were sleeping with slave women and begetting children and whatnot, and if you actually are writing a history of that dynamic and that power differential and that experience of the American Republic, then that can be a really useful and important historical evidence,
right,
in support of that. So it really does depend on context. But then another issue I was thinking about while you were speaking was there's a lot of overlap when you talked about the sports figures with 1970s radical gay politics that were really invested in visibility and invested in outing people, because for them, visibility was the most important element, and that it was, they believed that it was not just an issue of privacy, but it was dangerous not to have visibility of public gay figures and lesbian figures, and that for them it was important to out high profile individuals to show, one, that visibility, and there was examples, but also sometimes to highlight hypocrisy of individuals that were involved in homosexual activity but potentially homophobic in their behavior politically or otherwise. So they had a very specific politics that for them supported that outing of public figures. And like I said, for them, that issue of visibility and the wider good that they felt they were achieving was far more important than any individual.
Yeah. And that's one of those things that I sort of struggle with when, you know, conservative politicians in the United States who, you know, are against gay marriage, say, and then it turns out that they're gay themselves. The way those stories are reported, that it always makes me uncomfortable, though, and just the way it's done, and the sort of the jubilation that seems to happen from the other side when this person gets outed. And it's, coming out or being outed, it strikes me as that's the sort of thing that should happen on that person's terms.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And to be forced to do it, regardless of the reason, even if there's this, like you said, with a conservative politician, yeah, maybe there's a good reason to do it and something good could happen, but it just strikes me as just not the best way to do things, or at least, you know, to revel in it. It just really strikes me as wrong.
Well, and that speaks again to the voyeurism that you were talking about, right, where it really is that sort of, there's a voyeurism and a titillation and these elements. And while I can certainly understand the politics, I mean, that's a less strong politics today.
Sure.
At least at a sort of activist level. I mean, there's certainly a sort of media interest that replicates it now for a different purpose that's more commercial and more, certainly more voyeuristic. While I can understand the activist impulse, particularly of that earlier period, it is, I mean, I think about myself, if I was under those conditions and was having that sort of taken from me, that sort of opportunity to choose on my own terms when I wanted and how I wanted to disclose anything about myself.
Mm-hmm.
It's also deeply problematic. Yes.
And the, I guess in the historical sense, then the people who are under study oftentimes don't have the opportunity to do anything themselves because, well, they're dead, right? So then that adds a different element. I mean, if somebody gets outed who's still alive, they have an opportunity to address it in some way. You know, with historical figures, you don't have that same opportunity. And there's a sensitivity that needs to be there, right?
Well, and also an awareness that they're going to have understood their sexuality differently than we're going to probably describe it.
Right.
And in a certain, I mean, I only work in the modern period, but even in that, there's a radical difference in how people understood their sexuality really within living memory than they do today. I mean, and I feel I'm only in my late 30s, and I feel like even for me, growing up in the 80s, I conceptualized my sexuality in a way that is, it has to be historicized. I think I understood my sexuality in much more black and white terms than what students of university, high school, maybe younger, are doing so today. There seems to be a very different awareness available to people just a generation or so behind me, which is sobering to see that you can historicize so quickly. Because I'm certainly not looking back on sort of a lifetime of 80 years and seeing, well, look at how much has changed. It's, I'm looking really at one generation behind me and feeling that they really understand sexuality differently than how I was socialized and how I can conceive of it for myself, which is really interesting to recognize to what extent this is historical and social and cultural, even though I feel my sexuality in my bones, how stable it is for me myself. But I recognize that had I been born 10, 15 years later, I might be experiencing something very different, even in the same me.
Right. Yeah. And then bringing it back then to you as the instructor, then that would again change the way that you would approach it in a classroom.
Absolutely. I mean, recognizing that, I would potentially have a lot to learn from those students as well, on, especially if we were doing a gender studies, gender history, gay and lesbian studies history course, where these things come much more up to the moment. I probably, just because of the nature of my research and the period that I'm familiar with, I wouldn't be doing something exclusively related to medieval history. There's no way that I would be teaching very much that would have no impact from present in terms of people's, like, coming up to the period of people's experience or within living memory. So I definitely am aware that when I would have the opportunity to teach those courses, that would be, it would be a relationship with the students, and it would be hopefully learning a lot from them as well. And getting a better sense of the sort of diversity and fluidity of sexuality that a lot of people potentially experience, and remarkably parallels more historical understandings that I research, where people did understand their sexualities more fluidly in the past and didn't have, well, we perhaps have more terms to describe sexuality. The people that I research didn't have necessarily the same categories, but seemed to have a lot more flexibility and a lot more fluidity in how they could conceptualize themselves and their sexuality in various contexts than, say, in the post-World War II to the end of the 20th century period.
Yeah, it's something that struck me when I've been reading the Notch's blog, is that you see that, and then you wonder, I mean, who is more liberated? I mean, these people who could, you know, express these things. Sure, it was done privately, but there wasn't the same sort of strict, you have to identify as this, and that's what you are for all eternity. Right? It's really interesting in that I think we're starting to get back towards that a little bit more, and it's just the difference is that that's public as opposed to private.
Yeah, it really is interesting to see that sort of transition, and I think that's why I'm so fascinated with contemporary expressions of sexuality, because I think it does replicate in some ways, or parallel, or whatever word we want to use, things that are, or experiences that are historical in nature, things that I've researched, where I feel like someone who's 19 right now might in some ways see themselves in someone from the 1930s in ways that I wouldn't.
Right. Yeah.
So it's really interesting, because I'm often, a friend of mine often says that the history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
Yes.
And it's interesting how there's experiences now that are rhyming with the past.
Yes. Yeah. That's one of my favorite sayings too, is history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And, you know, and like you say, these things are very generational, and you know what, in 10 years, there will be another crop of students who are coming into university who will probably have a completely different view on these things than the students do now. And it'll continue to change as things do. And this is an issue that is really active in how it's being addressed and how it's changing. And I think of, even from when I started my undergraduate degree in 2003, it's a completely different situation in the way sexuality and the history of sexuality is being addressed. And it's really quite remarkable.
No, I agree with you completely. I mean, I started my undergrad in 1995 in Lethbridge. And when you were talking about, you were at Nipissing, did you say, for your undergrad?
Yeah.
When you were describing that a little bit, it still was echoing to me my memories of Lethbridge in the in the mid to late 1990s, where, gosh, yeah, no, I wasn't aware of anyone that was publicly out or working on sexuality studies or history. I mean, there would have been in other departments, I imagine, and there would have been some work, and certainly there was a women's studies program there, and there was a strong sociology program. But in history, there was less going on, certainly less than there is, far less than there is now at the University of Lethbridge. But it's, yeah, I think it's in my experiences of being in a smallish city in the 90s, going to university and encountering a lot of new things and not encountering them as well when I was looking for them, definitely informs how I look at my place in the academy now.
And that place in the academy, like we said, is an honorary research fellow at Birkbeck University of London, Shirk, postdoctoral fellow at McGill, editor at Notches. You can check that out, notchesblog.com. And you have your book manuscript that you're working on called The Pink Pound, Queer Prophets in 20th Century Britain, which you're currently revising, and hopefully we'll see that in the not-too-distant future.
Hopefully, yes. Thank you. All of these activities are certainly informing the revision and my approach to it. So it's now just a matter of, well, all of us know, just sort of buckling down and, among other tasks, rewriting the proposal, revising chapters, and getting it off to the publisher and seeing what happens.
Yes, yes. Well, hopefully it all goes well for you. And like we say, if you haven't read the blog post, it's called Coming Out in the Classroom When the Personal is Pedagogical. Like I say, we'll link to it in the post, and you can also find it on the Notches blog. And check it out. It's a really interesting read. And the comments below, normally I don't read comments, because comment boards tend to be dreadful. And I think that'd be polite to refer to them as dreadful. But this one is actually really interesting, and it's not just people calling each other horrible names.
Yeah, they were really engaged and had some conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's not just the post, but be sure to scroll down and check out the comments as well. And the author of the piece, Justin Ben-Gray, joining us from London. Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you so much. I've really, really enjoyed this.
I very much enjoyed it as well. I'm really glad that we could get you on. Anybody, if you have questions and comments for the podcast, it's historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is @DrShawneeFever. And I forgot to mention, Justin's Twitter is @JustinBengree. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.